Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm fine.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Elon Musk's first couple weeks at Twitter are going pretty well. First, he posted a link to a conspiracy theory website about Paul Pelosi being attacked as part of a gay tryst before deleting it. Then he rolled out a new plan to charge the site's most engaged users for all the free content they were providing. Then he laid off a bunch of folks before realizing, ah, crap, I laid off too many folks. I got to get them back here. And I realize we're going to be talking about Elon's takeover of Twitter. I realize that this is a little far afield from the movie aisle, the titular movie aisle of this podcast. But it does deal with an impact the culture more broadly and thus is worth discussing here. Plus, it's our show. Plus, we're all slaves to Twitter. We're all captured by Twitter. You are too. Admit it. Admit it. You want to talk about Elon. All right. Anyway, moving on from my apologia for what we're doing today. The change causing the most consternation, certainly amongst my peer set, is the changes that involve the blue check system, right? The verification system. Twitter. Elon has said he wants to roll out a new version of Twitter Blue that will charge people $8 a month, and it will include a verification badge as part of the perk package, except it's entirely unclear what the badge will actually mean, right? Is Twitter going to be checking IDs, making sure usernames match up with those IDs, or is he going to be matching usernames to credit cards? What does a verification actually mean if you just give a bunch of pseudonymous accounts the badge? And look, there's nothing wrong with being a pseudonymous account. I don't quite understand what it means other than like, okay, I paid $8 to be on Twitter Blue and now I have this badge. It's like an NFT except dumber somehow. But part of the problem here goes way back, goes back to pre-Musk Twitter. Can you remember such a time, pre-Elon Musk Twitter, when some dum-dum at the Bird app decided to strip Milo Yiannopoulos of his blue check as part of after he did a series of bad, possibly Nazi-affiliated tweets? I can't even remember what, but they were bad tweets. It changed everything, because rather than a check mark simply meaning, like, this person is who they say they are, the decision to do this meant that the blue check actually meant this person is who they say they are, and also they don't tweet anything we find terribly offensive. We actually agree with most of what they tweet. That's the implication, at least, which means that every time the Ayatollah tweets something, Twitter's like, yeah, he's fine, I guess. We're fine with the Ayatollah. Whatever. One thing Elon is definitely right about. I will say this. One thing he is absolutely right about is that restricting who can get the blue check mark is idiotic. Restricting it by profession is idiotic. Restricting it by public notoriety is idiotic. Anyone who can prove who they are and who wants to tweet under their own name should be allowed to get one. They should be allowed to get one. And you could even make the case that it makes sense to charge for the privilege, because after all, someone's got to check those IDs and make sure the account names aren't being monkeyed about with and that sort of thing. But the ridiculous way that this has all played out has understandably reduced any faith anyone has in the website in general. Peter, have you set up your Mastodon server yet? Are you at Peter Cocktailman 127 at mastodon.social.369? I don't understand how that dumb site works.
Oh, me neither. I but that's because I'm like so over Mastodon already. I've already moved on to Gas and Be Real. You guys know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Those all sound made up.
Regrettably.
They're totally real social networks because we live in an era of competition and nobody has to be on Twitter, and you can be on a lot of other social networks or none of them. And it's great. And I think all of this is, it's mostly amusing. The people I feel worst for here, I think there's basically no downside for the general public. There's obviously some downside for people who lose their jobs. And even if those people, in some cases, like, even if those are obviously, like, sort of good cuts, like, just from a business perspective, I always feel bad when somebody loses their job. Like, that sucks. It's really unpleasant. And I don't want to be, like, celebrating that. The same time, from a discourse perspective, from a, like, what does this do to how America talks to each other? And by America, I mean, like, 1,000 journalists who are totally obsessed with Twitter and spend all of their time on it, because those two are the same thing, right? Like, there doesn't seem to be to be an obvious downside here. Like, maybe Musk does turn Twitter into something really interesting and like a great platform for debate and speech, where like we can all talk to each other and like the like ideas are celebrated, and people don't get banned for saying stuff that like is, you know, a little bit controversial but believed by large portions of the public. Or maybe Elon Musk has no idea how to run a social network, how to run a social media network. Maybe he melts this whole thing down and loses $40 billion or something.
$44 billion.
Like, that's a lot of money. That's like government program level money. And then he doesn't have Twitter, and neither do we. And I would win from that scenario, because the main thing I want out of Twitter is for it to be less useful. My primary annoyance with Twitter over the last several years is that it has continued to be useful in some way, and therefore I have to pay attention to it. But if Twitter could become less useful and less interesting, especially to journalists, I think that actually might be a good thing. On the other hand, if Twitter could become more useful and like more effective in certain ways, that would probably be a good thing too. And either way, it's okay, unless you lose your job, in which case, like, I to be clear, like, that sucks, and I feel bad for you.
Alyssa, what do you make of all this? Because I mean, I once again, I am like, I'm certainly the most sympathetic person to Elon Musk at the Bulwark. I find him to be an interesting figure. I am generally pro him in terms of electric cars and space travel and satellite technology and that sort of thing. It also seems like he clearly has no idea what he's doing here and is much more likely to break all of this than to make it work any better. But maybe Peter's right that it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if Twitter were to be forever irrevocably broken and we all had to like start up our own Substacks and we could just bring the blogosphere back. Microblogging can die, blogosphere come back. Yay.
So first off, I actually want to announce that I have taken an equity stake in Gitter because they need a liberal for people to have someone to yell at. And so I will be quitting this podcast to make just enormous amounts of money being yelled at by conservatives on the internet.
Wait, is that site making money, though? Aren't all of the conservative Trumpy
ones?
No sites
are making money. Come on,
not
they have like
making
400,000 daily users, which is more than the metaverse. So maybe that tells you something. So look, the real reason we're talking about Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter on Across the Movie Aisle is because it's entertaining, right? I mean, this is effectively reality television where the world's richest man is having the world's like a world historically expensive midlife crisis, and we're all just along for the ride in real time, man. Like, it's amazing.
Why couldn't he be normal and just like buy a Ferrari or an island
or Mars, right? Like, if Elon Musk's, you know, 40th, like 50th or whatever, I have no idea how old Elon Musk is, if his like big birthday present to himself was just like, I'm gonna colonize Mars, like I'm gonna plant a flag with like the Tesla logo in, you know, one of these, like in, you know, Mons Pavonis, and like conquer Mars for Elon Musk, like that would be awesome. But no, like the guy is flailing around running a social media company. It's ridiculous. And I mean, again, like, obviously, I agree with everything that Peter says about it being terrible for people who are like losing their jobs and being asked to reapply for them. Just awful. And I actually agree with Sunny that I find Musk pretty interesting and even on some level inspiring, right? I mean, given how completely dorky the environmental movement has been forever, the fact that this guy not only sort of makes electric sports cars possible, but completely rebrands them as like cool and desirable and awesome is like a generationally useful thing for him to have done. Like, that's great. The serious tragedy of Musk getting sucked into Twitter is that Elon Musk could be like actually perfecting rooftop solar that doesn't look terrible, or like, you know, fueling a space program that's going to let the US compete with China and achieve, you know, space dominance in a serious and world historically important way. This is the least useful thing that Elon Musk could be spending his time on. And it's really depressing to see someone of this vision and capability wasting his time on this garbage. But that said, just like watching him beclown himself in this fashion is incredibly amusing. Not least because it's incredibly funny to see someone who has basically convinced himself that he can do no wrong, that even like his habit of dicking around on the internet is worth like billions of dollars, right? I mean, Matt Levine at Bloomberg has written how like stocks are basically worth what Elon Musk says they're worth on Twitter. And so watching someone who is so completely full of himself just self-immolate in public is hilarious, right? Like, this is, we're basically living in an Armando Iannucci movie, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, what, so the way somebody described it on Twitter was like, it's like every Twitter user has become the mean kids in the class when the substitute teacher shows up and we're all trying to make him cry at the same time. Like that.
And it's working, right? I mean,
it totally. I mean, like, this is the thing here is that, like, you know, everyone who has been a Twitter addict or is currently a Twitter addict, I'm not raising my hand, but I am raising my hand, knows that feeling when you are posting too much, when you've gotten into an argument that you cannot possibly win, and 7,000 different people, it feels like, are yelling at you, and you're trying to answer and block and answer and block and block and answer and retweet, quote tweet.
Sonny, is that how you feel right now?
If you get to that point, it's like playing poker. If you get to that point, you have already lost. Like, you are on tilt. You got to get away from the table. You just got to close your laptop, put your phone in a safe and throw away the key, get out. And he can't do that now because he's tied himself to this thing with the money that will, if he loses it, will probably destroy the actual companies that he is good at running.
Yeah.
I don't know that I think that that's necessarily true, although obviously it's enough money that it's really quite significant. I think his vision for Twitter that he has outlined over the course of the last several months as this process has played out is appealing in some ways. Now, I'm not sure he's going to be able to execute on that vision, especially given the last week or so. It really seems like he's kind of flailing. At the same time, it's just quite difficult to take over a large company, especially in this manner. And I think
when like the advertising market is collapsing anyway,
right? Like heading into a recession, heading into either a recession or at least what Big Business right now expects is going to be a recession. It's going to be a challenging environment, period. But his vision of a place for like interesting, not personally hostile discussion where ideas are respected, even if they are bad ideas, or wrong ideas, you know, where people can actually talk to each other and disagree, is like, there's a little bit of the, you know, of this podcast's DNA in that vision. Again, whether or not he can execute on that is the big question. And who the hell knows? Like, if you're just going to bet whether he's going to succeed or fail, you kind of have to bet that he's going to fail just because most things fail, especially at this scale.
Elon Musk himself is the antithesis of, at least the way he behaves on Twitter, is the antithesis of what he wants the site to be, right? I mean, this is a guy who gets sued and, you know, ultimately wins a defamation case for just, like, calling a random, like, guy working on a Thai cave rescue a pedo guy. Like, he's retweeting random conspiracy theories about Paul Pelosi. He's tweeting Nazi memes today. Like, I mean, the way that he pronounces about politics is, like, the most surface level, like, I had a beer with Andrew Yang nonsense that, you know, I mean, he is like, this is someone who is, because he has been successful in some areas, is convinced that he's just like a world historical genius and is proceeding in such a way that reveals himself to be just wrong, right? Like, it's such an epic self-own. That's what's world historical about it. It's amazing.
I also think that there's a way in which this is his metaverse. And I mean that in two different ways. So Mark Zuckerberg, you know, has plowed a huge amount of Facebook's really considerable resources into building out the metaverse, which is this sort of virtual world in which people can interact, right? The kind of second lifestyle, but through, you know, goggles and like, it's much more immersive kind of stuff, right? Like, there's a whole big thing and we don't need to go into all of that. His vision is that like the metaverse is the thing that will follow social media, that will come after social media. And so far, no one is using it. They're spending a huge amount of money on it. And Facebook has just lost a huge, huge amount of value, is expected to lay off a ton of people this week. But the metaverse is this like fantasy of an interactive future world. That's also what Twitter is for Elon Musk right now. And a thing that I think people are underrating a little bit about Elon Musk is that he is a video gamer. And he is a hardcore video gamer. He has talked about spending dozens or hundreds or maybe a thousand. I think he might have even mentioned that he spent 1,000 hours playing Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, which is a game that you can sink that much time into. I've spent hundreds of hours playing that myself. On the other hand, I'm not running Tesla and a space company. He posted a picture, like a screen cap of his Elden Ring character, which that he'd like totally maxed out. Elden Ring being like a famously incredibly difficult, time-consuming sort of twitchy game with that he clearly had spent well over 100, if not hundreds and hundreds of hours playing. He's a gamer, and he is obsessed with Twitter in the way that video gamers become obsessed with video games. And he wants now to own that world so that he can remake it according to his wishes. And I think that like people are sort of, it's not just that he is somebody who had success in one area and thinks he's going to have success in another area. It's also that he is somebody who has become obsessed with this immersive game world that has, I don't think it's addictive in the classical sense, but it certainly has properties of like a kind of like people can't let go and people can't turn away from it and some, you know, and sort of can't help themselves. And in the same way that he loves to spend hundreds of hours building his character in Elden Ring and finding all the secrets, he wants that for Twitter. Like he has spent that amount of time and he is trying now to make that thing his own in the way that only a small number of billionaires can.
But isn't this part of what's interesting about this moment at both Twitter and Facebook is that these guys who, you know, famously were tastemakers to a certain extent, right? Like Mark Zuckerberg invented the place where people socialized with each other. Musk made Tesla's incredibly popular and cool. They seem to have mistaken their own tastes for the tastes of the general population. And Zuckerberg is making a bet on the future that, like, maybe will pan out, although the timing seems really terrible, right? To do this at the moment, precisely when, like, even people who are quite COVID cautious are venturing back out into the world, remembering that, like, the real world is great, that they're happy to be in it. And Musk appears to have, like, he appears to really enjoy just being extremely online. And I think most people don't enjoy being online in precisely that way, right? Like, there are a small number of people who are just, like, they live to be reply guys or whatever. But, like, the idea that Musk wants to sit around, like, getting stoned and been like, let's talk about, like, how to build a government on Mars. Pedo guy! It's, like, not actually how most people want to spend their time. And so there appears to be just some level of confusion at work here. And it's like it's fascinating to watch both of them sort of bet the farm in the same way.
He's maxing out his stats in the discourse game.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing it reminded me of, and we'll move on here a sec, but the thing it reminded me of was I remember when I was like, you know, 13 or 14 or whatever, and I was like, if I win the lottery, I'm going to buy my comic book store. I'm going to run it. It's going to be great. I'm going to hang out with, and that's kind of what it feels like he is doing with Twitter to the same extent that like I would have been doing this in like 1995, which would have been the absolute height of the comic book boom. And there was nothing but downhill after that. And that is basically when he has bought Twitter, is at the absolute height of the tech social media bubble that we lived in. And there's just nothing but downhill now. It's like I just can't see this ending in anything but tears for essentially everyone involved, including perhaps us. Serious question. You guys going to pay the $8 for Twitter Blue to keep your check, but also be able to edit tweets and you move up in the reply priorities, et cetera, et cetera? Peter.
No.
Alyssa.
I don't know what the Washington Post is going to decide to do on my behalf.
Oh, see, that's a good question. See, this is actually something I suggested, that it would actually make sense for Twitter to go to the various news organizations and be like, look, you got to pay us $1 million a year and we'll verify everybody and, you know, we'll heighten your placements and searches or whatever, which I think would be smart of them. This doesn't come anywhere near servicing the $44 billion in, you know, purchase price, but it's at least a start. I will not be paying the $8 for the record. I'm not, not going to happen.
Personally, I will not be spending that sort of money, but...
I have other things I want to spend. You know how many Blu-rays I can buy for $8? One. All right. Make sure to check out our special bonus episode in which we're going to pick our favorite movies of the year pre-award season division, right? As we all know, Hollywood loves to cram every good movie for adults into the last 2 months of the year, because why would anybody go see a movie that was aimed at adult audiences before November 1? But, you know, whatever. That is what it is. What this episode suggests is that in the preceding 10 months, there are probably at least one or two good movies that could enter the Best Picture consideration or conversation, all right? Now, on to the main event. Tar! It's the first new movie from director Todd Field in 16-some years. Tar stars Kate Blanchett as Lydia Tar, a conductor for the Berlin Philharmonic, whose style and sensibility has made her a bit of a celebrity, at least with the New Yorker NPR set, right? She looks the part. She's wearing a perfectly tailored custom suit that we see lovingly measured and cut and put together as the film opens. She talks the part, right? She's holding court with Adam Gopnik in a chat about what it means to be a conductor and what it means to be a female conductor in particular and what that means to her. And she acts the part, dressing down a pan-gender BIPOC student at Juilliard after he suggests he simply cannot appreciate Bach because the dead white man was such a misogynist. This movie is about power and power dynamics, right? In the early going, Tar has the power. She has power over the donor to her fellowship program. She wields that kind of over him because while he has the money, she has the skill and the insights into what he really wants to do, which is to be a conductor. And she has power over her assistant conductor at the Philharmonic, right? She wants to replace him with somebody else. She has power over a little girl in the movie who is bullying her daughter, and she like goes up to this little girl and is like, if you don't stop kicking my kid in the shins, I'm going to disappear you. And no one will tell you that I threaten you with this, because if you complain about it, they will believe me because I am an adult. It's like the most basic fundamental building block of human power, of that of a big person over a little person. And it kind of fits in thematically with everything else that's going on. But those dynamics change as the film progresses, right? When a beautiful cellist joins the Berlin Philharmonic, she finds herself smitten. When a former student with whom Tar had a relationship kills herself, she finds herself embroiled in social media scandal. And when she becomes too toxic in general, she loses her job and her wife takes her adopted daughter away. And eventually she is reduced to serving as a traveling conductor at a symphony that plays for a crowd with a dress code that is slightly different from the black tie set she is used to wowing. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Again, there's going to be spoilers in this movie, so, you know, if you want to go watch it first, please do that. Turn us off now. Whatever. All of which is to say that some folks have pigeonholed this movie as a cancel culture story. They look at that scene with the pan-gender BIPOC kid and they're like, oh, well, this is about, you know, the cancel culture and how, you know, reactionaries are unfairly treated and, you know, well, that's no good. I don't believe that at all. This was basically Richard Brody's review at the New Yorker. But it's not that, actually. It's a Me Too story. This is a Me Too story. Lydia Tarr is not Justine Sacco. She is Harvey Weinstein, or at least kind of a diminutive version of Weinstein, of the sort that we've actually seen a couple of times in the classical music community. Tarr is it's a fascinatingly thorny movie for me, one that sets up, or offers up at least, some real questions of interpretation. And I think Field does a pretty masterful job of dealing in ambiguity in this movie. We don't know the extent of Lydia's transgression with the student who killed herself, but we have some idea, given her assistant's kind of freaking out after the girl kills herself. And then we see the emails that she scrolls through. There's some bad stuff in there. We're kind of curious how far it all went. And the last 30 minutes or so of the picture offer a kind of interestingly ambiguous fate for Lydia Tarr. This is a question we can discuss a little more, but I'm curious what you guys make of that kind of final shot, that pullback in the unnamed Asian symphony. If it's a cosmic joke at her expense, kind of designed to take her down a peg and reduce her power further, or is it something of a synthesis, right? Like an idea that pulls together this notion that music can change and be different. It doesn't have to be the same or orchestral stuff, but it also needs to be taken seriously. It needs to be taken importantly. We have to ask what the composer was thinking when he put it together. I don't know. I'm kind of two minds on that. But let's hear what you guys think. Alyssa, what did you make of Tar?
I loved this movie. And I appreciate its ambiguities so much, not just even in what we're supposed to think of the main character and how we're supposed to interpret that final scene. But even in terms of some very basic plot questions, when Peter and I saw it last week, I walked out of it and I asked him, do you think that Francesca, Lydia's assistant, and Olga, the cellist, are working together on some level? Or do they sort of know each other? What is the connection there? Because, you know, you have this sense that there are two people who are documenting some of Lydia's movements and sharing them with other people. And the movie never reveals who's done that or what their motivations are. And that's just like, that's a lacuna in the middle of the movie that in a lesser film, I think would feel really frustrating. And in a movie sort of this controlled and careful and interesting, you know, it just opens up space in an interesting way. This feels like a world in which people are living and acting outside the confines of the frame, right? And, you know, there have been a couple of reviews that, or even sort of jokey pieces that get at this in a way. You know, I think Anthony Lane talked about, you know, Lydia Tarr just sort of being alive in a fundamental way. Vulture ran an extremely funny listicle. It's like 47 facts about Lydia Tarr, about her as like sort of reactionary figure. But the movie is sort of ambiguities and the things that it refuses to answer, rather than feeling like holes, really lend themselves to a sense that this is a real movie about real people. And, you know, so do its ambiguities, right? I mean, because for all this is, you know, a, you know, visually big, sonically big movie, it's also very confined to Lydia's perspective, right? And I think one of the things that's fascinating about it as a Me Too story is that it's a Me Too story from the perspective of the predator, right? From the perspective of someone who is, you know, radically compartmentalized in certain ways, who uses her power in ways that, like, she clearly, you know, is able to not think about at various times. And, you know, I think that it's, you know, it's very, I think Field can do that in part because his character is a woman. Like, if you pitched a movie, it's like, why don't you spend almost 3 hours inside the head of Harvey Weinstein? Like, most people would just revolt at that. They wouldn't want to do it. And so to have this be a woman, to have it be someone whose transgressions, if not illuminated, seem to be, like, it does not seem like Lydia Tarr is a serial rapist, right? It seems like she is someone who probably has had inappropriate relationships with some of her students and subordinates of the sort that, like, may have seemed consensual to the younger participants at the time, but seemed to be less so in retrospect. But it creates this, you know, this is a character who people are willing to spend time with, even though she's clearly not a good person on a lot of levels. And the movie is also very good at tricking you into sympathizing with her. Like, Sonny, you, like me, are a parent. Like, tell me you didn't crack up a little bit in that scene where she's, like, threatening the other kid on the playground. Right?
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
Right? It's like, it's, I mean, she's an, you know, in that scene, Lydia is expressing an impulse that I think, like, every parent has had occasionally, but almost all of us are just, like, too socialized to indulge, right? Like, neither of us would ever go up and be like, I'm going to get you. I'm going to make you disappear, right? Yeah. Like,
well, it's funny. The way I described that in my review was as cathartically bitchy.
Yeah.
Because it's like inappropriate on a very serious level, but there's a catharsis to it that you feel internally that, like, maybe makes you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah.
But you're like, yes, I get it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if the movie has a weakness, I do actually think it's that scene at Juilliard, which is really slanted, right? I mean, a kid who's at Juilliard is going to have, like, some level of interest in music. And might, you know, render it inarticulately when confronted with someone sort of at Tarr's level. But the scene is so skewed that it becomes less interesting, right? I mean, Lydia doesn't have to defend anything here. I mean, because the argument is totally insubstantial. It's non-existent. And so, you know, the display of intellectual firepower that she supposedly unleashes on this kid is actually a little bit substance-free because it's meeting with no real challenge. And so it could be, and I think the scene is defensible in the sense that the movie takes place so narrowly for most of it from within Lydia's perspective, that to a certain extent that scene may be sort of what she hears as opposed to what the kid actually says. But I think it actually diminishes her to have that scene written as sort of flimsily as it is.
Can I ask a question about this? Because I feel like that's actually kind of the point of the scene. I think at least part of the point of the scene here is, like, she is destroying this kid. And again, while it is, like, cathartic to, as somebody who agrees with her and, like, thinks that the thinks that Max, the kid in question, is, like, kind of a sniveling dork and, like, is a decent stand-in for people who believe that sort of thing in general. I think that the whole point of that scene is to be like, look at her essentially abusing her power. Yeah. Like, she is abusing her power in a very real way here, because a teacher should not treat even an idiot student like that.
Yeah.
There's no kindness in it. But there's something else in that scene that I think is actually really important to focus on. I liked it better, I think, than Alyssa, that particular scene. But she goes up to the piano when she's trying to show him classical, sort of more classical music and the value of it. And she does this thing where this shtick that sort of becomes relevant throughout the whole movie is, what is the artist's intention? But then she plays the same works several different ways. She's interpreting the artist. And like, in the process, she's showing you that the exact same thing can be interpreted multiple ways without fundamentally changing the notes, the meter, the rhythm, right? Like, it's the same song, just played different ways through a different from a different perspective, right? You can do it as ragtime, you can do it as jazz, you can do it as, you know, sort of a lush, you know, kind of symphonic classical. And this is something that the movie is sort of, again, very tricky about, in that on the one hand it seems to be saying, well, we always need to ask what the artist's what was the artist thinking, what was their intention. And then it's also always telling us that the artist's intention is not something we can necessarily access, that we are inevitably seeing and hearing everything through some sort of interpretive lens, and that interpretation colors how we understand what is happening. And so the question I want to ask you guys is, what is the worst thing that Tar does? Because when you think about it, she seems like somebody who is certainly abusing of her power in certain ways, right? Like, I agree that that scene at Juilliard shows, like, it's not necessarily wildly out of bounds behavior, right? Like, for a teacher to just sort of lord over their students. At the same time, it shows no kindness. It's not particularly nice. It's not, right, sort of, like, it's suggestive of her character. The scene with the kid, again, that is a kind of abuse of power, right? For sure. But as you said, Sunny, like, there's something cathartic about it. We don't ever see her actually manipulating the students who she is supposed to have, you know, sort of, slept with or whatever, right? That's all being filtered through the New York Post, which we as journalists have complicated, you know, we could like spend a lot of time on what does it mean that it's, but no, but we're the way the movie presents the New York Post is, oh, that's a gossip rag. You don't shouldn't necessarily believe everything that they print there. To be clear, we don't need to spend a lot of time on the New York Post and its journalistic standards here. But that's how the movie presents it. And I'm not saying that the movie is telling us, I really want to be clear. The movie, I don't believe that the movie is definitely telling us actually all this stuff is made up. But I think there's a way in which you can look at this and come away thinking, oh man, she's obviously kind of a manipulative, power-abusing monster. And then you think back about what the movie actually shows us that she actually does on screen where we can see it. And it's not that she comes across as a particularly nice person, or as somebody who is very kind and supportive. But there's also that scene, you know, with her mentor, who talks about sexual assault allegations or sort of that sort of thing in the classical music community, in which he says, well, you know, these days, allegations are a substitute for evidence. This movie has a lot of allegations. Does it provide us with a lot of evidence?
I mean, the closest thing to tangible evidence, there are two different things. One is the fact that she's clearly haunted by this girl in her dreams. I mean, we get flashes of that, glimpses of that. And it's hard to say. It's again, it's up to interpretation. You couldn't say for sure what that actually means.
Anyone who has ever had a disturbing relationship, even with an online troll, can understand possibly being haunted by that person in your dreams, especially if you at one point knew that person. Again, I'm not saying the movie is telling. To be clear,
you asked
I'm not
me saying that. You the asked movie a question.
Is,
can
is
I answer the question?
Her, yeah.
All right. So the other two things, we see her deleting all the emails where she is like clearly torpedoed this girl's career. It's open to question again whether or not she was being truthful. And then the other thing is the assistant who clearly believed that they had some sort of like possibly thruple like relationship. They spent a lot of time together in that cabin. They were very close. She doesn't come right out and say that they were in an intimate sexual relationship, but it is very clearly, I think, on the edges of that conversation that Tar shuts down immediately.
It's implied, but it's not stated. And you can imagine that a trio of artists might have had a different sort of very intimate relationship, though I don't know that I necessarily subscribe to that interpretation. I'm just saying that this movie is so incredibly precise and tricky about what it presents, and that it, even if you, I think, are watching this movie very closely and sort of alive to the ways, to the ambiguities and to the things that it doesn't tell you, you come away with some sort of impression, and then you think back, well, what is my evidence for that impression? And it's always, there's something sort of not, that the movie isn't quite giving you. You're always reading into implications, and that is what the movie is in part about, is the ways in which we inevitably are reading into implications of things.
Well, and also, she lies about being assaulted, right? Like, that's, the movie deals with that in a very strange way. Like, it's very odd that no one in her life, like, insists that there be a police investigation, that she, like, go to the doctor.
She lies, but maybe she's just embarrassed and she's trying to retain control over a difficult situation. You know, she doesn't exactly want to tell people that she followed her student. I understand that I'm, like, pushing a somewhat, you know, aggressive interpretation here. At the same time, this is a movie about the ways that in which aggressive interpretation is inherent in the way we see everything, in the way we understand the characters of these purported monsters.
But that's part of the point I'm making, right? If this is a movie that, you know, sort of lulls you into believing something that may not be true, then to have the main character making a false accusation that we know to be false is very interesting to have on screen, right? It's like, it's, you know, again, it's one of those sort of ambiguities that I think plays nicely into what you're saying. And I would actually argue that, like, lying about being assaulted is one of the worst things that she does in the movie, because it causes other people fear and anxiety. And because politically, false accusations are so, you know, are a damaging thing to have out there. I mean, I think, like, actually the worst thing she does is string Francesca along and then not give her the promotion that she promised and, like, clearly had suggested was in the offing.
No, I think the worst thing she does is the audition for the cellist solo. Because that's the thing that, like, destroys her with the rest of the... I mean, in terms of, like, I mean, I don't know about morally the worst, but it's the thing that is the worst for her in the movie, because it destroys her position within the symphony. It shows to everybody else that she's, like, putting her thumb on the scale for this person who she's clearly infatuated with. And it plays into all of the other threads that are kind of hanging out there about what her MO is like with younger, less powerful people.
Sonny asked at the very beginning what we made of that final scene, that final shot in which it pans out and she's at, like, something like an anime convention, right? A cosplay convention in the final shot of the movie. And there's this great voiceover that booms through the music that says something to the effect of let no one judge you but yourself. And I think that scene is about one of the other big themes that we haven't talked about, which is just that this is a movie about self-mythology and whether or not someone can sort of construct an identity, right? So one of the big reveals late in the film is that she's not actually Lydia. She's Linda, that she's comes from this very humble background, that she's built up this myth of herself as the genius auteurist, you know, conductor who is the one person who makes all the difference. And of course, the movie is constantly subtly signaling, maybe not so subtly in some cases, that in fact her genius is the product of all of the people who go into making the thing that she does, from her assistant on down to the rest of the orchestra. This is present even at the very beginning of the film. My favorite little touch here is the credit sequence, where you hear just in voiceover, you hear Lydia Tarr say to someone, "Sing as if there's no microphone present," something to the effect, something like that. And then the credits roll and they're backwards, and it's all of the below the line production people who made this movie possible, from the crafts, you know, the craftsmen and the you know, the folks bringing the food, the drivers and all of the right. And it is just this extended thing that you can't help but see. This is a movie in which in which a huge number of people went into the recording and making of it. It's not just Todd Field and Cate Blanchett geniuses. It's all of the other people, and it's sort of crediting them because they are the microphone and they are supposed to be invisible, right? They're supposed to be out of frame and you don't see them, but the movie forces you from the very, very beginning to see that that this is a product, even this relatively small budget sort of movie that not a lot of people are going to see. This is a product of dozens, if not hundreds, of craftsmen and artisans. And it's just a genius little touch that the movie reinforces all throughout.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Peter?
Great movie. Thumbs up.
Melissa?
Same. Two thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Good movie. And hopefully everyone goes to see it in a movie theater. I know that it's tough to get folks. It is long. It's a 2 hour, 40 minutes or so, but it doesn't feel that long. So, you know, you should treat yourself to an evening at the movies. Get a sitter for the kids, and then threaten the kids with disappearance if they don't behave for the sitter. All right, that is it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.